Hello.
Hi, Andy. So I'm calling to order our May 17th, 2023 Ventura Port District Board of Commission. We will start with a pledge. Jessica, would you mind leading us in a pledge of allegiance?
United States of America, and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Well done. Thank you. All right, we'll move on to a roll call. Madam Clerk.
Commissioner Rainey,
Present.
Vice Chair Gardena, here, Chair Blumenberg,
Here.
and Commissioners Stevens and Brennan will be absent today.
All right, next is the adoption of the agenda. Commissioners, what do you think of our agenda?
I move we adopt the agenda as presented.
I'll second that.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, we have adopted the agenda for the evening. All right, next is approval of minutes, and I want to note that we have two sets of minutes here. We have the May 3rd, our last meeting minutes, but we also have the meeting minutes from April 19th from the Public Facilities Corporation meeting. So we wanted to explicitly call out both. So, commissioners, any questions on those minutes? No. Any?
Do we want to move them separately?
I think
They
we could approve
can go
that
together.
together.
Okay. I'll move approval of the minutes for both the May 3rd Port Commission regular meeting and the April 19th Public Facilities Corporation meeting.
Second.
All right, we have a motion and a second to approve the May 3rd and April 19th public facilities minutes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Hearing none, we've approved both sets of minutes.
Thank you.
All right, we'll move on to public communications, a period set aside to hear public testimony on items that are not on tonight's agenda. Do we have any public comments?
There are no public
No
speakers.
public speakers online, seeing no one in front of us. We'll close public communications. Move on to board communications, an opportunity for the commissioners to present brief reports on port-related issues. Commissioners? Jackie?
I'll just be the first to mention that I was able to present to the City Council along with Chair Bloomberg and General Manager Brian Pendleton on the state of the port, and I think it was well received.
I'm happy to report that was the first commission meeting that I got my family to listen in on. They said you did great, by the way. I'll also add to that that my seat expires June 30th. Applications were due May 8th. I did apply for another term and interviews for that. There's got another applicant and myself. Interviews for that May 22nd at 2 o'clock. Between 2 and 4.
Yes.
So open to the public. You got to vote. You're welcome to attend. All right. With that, we will close board communications and move on to our staff and general manager report.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got some updates from marketing, and let me read through those. And then, of course, we've got our departmental reports from everybody from marketing to facilities to Harbor Patrol, capital projects, a lot of great detail and information about all the different things going on throughout the harbor, a lot of improvement projects and maintenance work in and around Harbor Village. So take a look at all of that, some great photos. On the marketing front, Mother's Day this past weekend at Ventura Harbor Village was a full house, starting on Friday through Sunday. Parking lots are very busy as many people brought mom, friends, and family to the village to celebrate. In honor of National Tourism Week and Tourism Month, Ventura Harbor once again launched a seaside vacay. I usually say vacation, but vacay it is. Getaway in May to promote travel to Ventura Harbor, Ventura Harbor Village, and Channel Islands National Park, working with and thank you to partners Island Packers and Four Points by Sheraton helping us out with that package. Entry includes annual visitor survey, prize includes hotel stays, trip to the islands, and village gift cards to dine and shop. Plus, the harbor had a booth out in the village thanking guests who were visiting the village last Thursday with stickers and giveaways. The port is recognizing Asian Pacific Heritage Month in May with a dedicated blog and video post featuring the longtime Harbor Tran family who fish out of Ventura Harbor and sell their catch at the Saturday Fisherman's Market in the village. On Saturday, we invite you to enjoy the return of the VW car show on the village main lawn on Saturday, May 20th, from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., along with live music and over, I guess, 95 and counting VW vehicles. We welcome the local Ventura group back to the harbor. Lastly, this weekend as well, the harbor parking lot at Schooner and Harbor Boulevard will serve as a shuttle lot for the California Strawberry Festival, which relocated to the Ventura Fairgrounds. So just as we have in the past provided a shuttle location for the annual fair, this year we're providing that to the Strawberry Festival in its new home at here in Ventura. That's going to be on May 20th and 21st, and we certainly hope people will come and hang out at the harbor in the village and enjoy the harbor before and after their attendance at the Strawberry Festival. Harbor marketing team will be working to cross-promote visitation to the village as well during the weekend. And that is our report. We have a couple of our staff members here. If you have any questions on facilities, capital projects, leasing, accounting, all of the above.
I just want to make sure I understood the waterproofing of the Margaritaville patio, because it says the restaurant's patio was started first with the objective of being completed prior to May 5th. Was it not able to be completed?
No, what the goal was to, the project is split in two, is we have the equipment room behind the patio for Margarita dining. And talking to the tenants, they really wanted to open up for Cinco de Mayo. So what we did is we changed gears and basically did that patio first. And then since we're going to go ahead and put equipment on the equipment room that's going to be feeding the downstairs, we're going to actually cut a hole in there and throw the debris through there. So it'll be less interruption to the tenant. So that's what the goal was, and we succeeded that.
Okay, good. So started first meant in before.
Correct.
The other project. Okay, I'm misread that particular sentence. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just wanted to put in the record so that anyone listening to this would know some of the things that we're looking at. One is a good accomplishment of the three restroom facilities that have been open to the public, and they look absolutely fabulous. I know that's one area in a facility that people often complain about, but it's done. It looks, they look nice. I think that if members of the public get an opportunity to look at the council agenda item, I would strongly encourage them to look at all of the capital projects that we've been doing. This is where your revenues and expenditures go with the port. It really enhances the facilities. It enhances the environment. It makes the port a fabulous place that you need to go. So I just wanted to just say that if anyone's watching this or listening, please go online and look at the pictures, because staff has taken the time to put very, very detailed descriptions and pictures that I think that the public should look at.
Well said, Tony. Thank you. I've heard our general manager talk how he judges the quality of a shopping environment by their bathroom. So we're first rate by that measure. Mm-hmm. So well done on that. Also want to say the loose cannon rework, the new doors, the brickwork looks awesome. And I think that's going to be a great attraction when we get that tenant in there. So looking forward to all that. Thank you. All right.
One more question. Do we have any gender neutral restrooms or just we do? Okay.
Yes, we do. We have one located at Brophy's building. It's family restroom, but right next to the elevator. It's in the hallway there. And the other one is Allen Packer 1691 building.
And are those Is that identified anywhere so people know?
We talked about signage, mm-hmm. and right now it's to word of mouth, but we're going to actually, okay. facilities looking into signage to put it on the old location and direct them that way.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
We don't have any public comments on the reports, do we?
No public Nothing. Speakers.
And nobody on. So we'll close the staff and general manager reports, move on to our consent agenda. Consent calendar is items that are expected to be non-controversial, acted upon with a single vote. We have three items on tonight's consent agenda. Approval of a new restaurant lease with Sugar Lab Bake Shop, which I think that's where our cookies came from tonight. Delicious mm-hmm. cookies. Thank you.
Power of persuasion.
Approval of amendment number 3 to a professional services agreement with Rincon to support our dredging services. And item C, approval of a professional services agreement with Jensen Design and Survey to provide services for the beach restrooms and shower and ADA access project. So, Brian, do you want to add anything to that before we?
No, only if there's questions from the board.
Do we have any public comments on the consent agenda?
No public speakers.
Board members, any comments?
I'll move the consent agenda.
A second.
And we have a motion and a second to approve the consent agenda. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, we have approved the consent agenda, including the lease agreement and the two professional services agreements. All right, we will move on to our standard agenda. First topic is our fiscal year 2023-2024 budget study session. I highlighted the year. Brian?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Next slide, please. Okay, so tonight we're going to start the fiscal year 23-24 budget process formally with what has become the first part of that process in the last 3 or so years, where we added a study session before presenting the formal budget, first as the preliminary budget and secondly as the final budget. So really a three-step process. Of course, the board could choose to add any additional steps it would like to along the way, but these are the ones that we've implemented over the last several years. So tonight's May 17th. We are scheduled for the preliminary budget on the first meeting of June, June 7th, and are planning for final budget adoption June 21st, which is ahead of the fiscal year start of July 1. Study session basically is an opportunity for board, stakeholders, engagement, staff discussion with the board. Look at funding priorities for the next fiscal year, which certainly are tied to our guiding principles and five-year objectives. And tonight you're going to hear from me a little bit on a couple of slides here that relate back to the board report. Joining us tonight is Mary Beth Redding, who Gloria will introduce with some information. Gloria will provide some additional information, as will our capital projects manager, Joe Gonzalez. So with that, we'll go to the next slide. Okay, so what you saw in the report is that we've been busy gathering information on both on revenues and expenditures and capital projects and also tenant improvements and so on. So you're not going to see a lot of specific detail in numbers other than capital projects tonight, but certainly a chance to kind of understand where we're headed and gather your input. But when we come back at that June 7th meeting, that's when we will have the full budget developed in its preliminary form, and we'll be asking the board to consider adoption of that preliminary budget. So you're going to see a little bit more high level, and I think it's a perfect opportunity for the board to discuss sort of policy objectives and things you might want to see in if you don't if they don't catch your eye here in our presentation. So as we look at revenues, those really come from three major sources, and Vice Chair just talked about the presentation with with City Council last week or the week before. And one of the things that we showed them is how the Port District generates its revenue. Almost 90% of it is self-derived from revenues coming from the Port District properties, with some additional, not insignificant amounts of money coming from property taxes. And then more and more in the last several years, the district has been successful with its team, administrative team, in securing a grant opportunity. So that has actually shifted that pie chart a little bit in our favor. So when we look at revenues, we sort of break them out into those categories: operational revenues, property taxes, and grants predominantly. So when we look at the operational revenues, we're looking at the areas of master tenants who are on long-term ground leases. We look at Harbor Village, which of course is our shopping center, and those types of leases are much more consistent with shopping centers generally. Commercial fishing activities, which goes hand in hand with this harbor being a working waterfront, and recreational fishing activities as well. So with master tenants, we've been meeting with various master tenants throughout the harbor, get their sense of how they view things moving forward in the next year. I would say largely you saw in the report a positive outlook on that. I think we suggested a potential 4 to 6% increase overall in total master tenant revenues. Probably the one area of concern is Ventura Water Pure as it relates to one or two of our master tenants who are along that pathway, and some uncertainty as to the amount of impact that could have on them. So I would say, putting those couple aside, generally speaking, both in terms of our own analysis of where revenues are today and where they would look to go forward based on conversations we've had, that looks pretty favorable. Harbor Village, we've done a pretty thorough analysis of all of the leases on the books today, where those leases are headed in terms of cost of living adjustments built into those or increases. You know, some of the analysis has to look at where we think percentage rents will go, and accounting for additional filling up of spaces, which predominantly would be in the former Comedy Club space, which is we're getting closer to getting under construction. That'll come back, and I think Joe will actually be touching on that in his list of projects. Having the what will become the Loose Cannon space, getting that filled, hopefully during the fiscal year. Those are some of the things that we look at in terms of analyzing those numbers. We have a little bit more modest look at increases there, I think in the about 3% range, I think is what we're suggesting there. Commercial fishing actually had a more positive year this last year than several prior years. That certainly the quantity of catch then ends up relating to things like slip demand and fuel sales and landings and all of, you know, the ancillary supply chain purchases that are made in around the harbor. Very hard to predict total catch amounts, but if we sort of stay on track with where we were at this year, that should be a fairly favorable number. Recreational fishing, a lot of that happens around the launch ramp, so we're a little uncertain ourselves, given, again, Water Pure impacts, and the project is going to cause the relocation of our dry slip boats, both ours and Director's, temporarily. Most of them will move to parking lot 19A at Schooner and Harbor. So that could cause some disruption in terms of revenue that comes from that. It's not a large percentage of our total revenue, but that certainly could have some bearing on our revenue numbers. Property taxes, we usually look at those and adjust those typically by about 2% annually, fairly conservatively, and the numbers tend to come in pretty close to what we predict there. And then on grants, we've had, as you saw in the report, and certainly you've approved receipt of grants and expenditure of grant monies, has been a significant amount of grant awards and successful applications. We have a couple that are out there. We tend not to put that... We don't want to put that revenue on the books unless we actually receive it. So sustainable grant funding is out there, and then also possible commercial fisheries facility project as a sub-applicant to Port of Wainemi is out there as well. Those aren't reflected here because we just don't know that those will come to fruition. But those are kind of the three main areas of revenues for us as we look at that total pie. And I think later on, Gloria's going to actually show that, at least in terms of how it looked to the city council when we showed it to them at that meeting. Next. Okay, expenses. So sort of the same thing. We talk in terms of operational expenses, just like we talked in terms of operational revenues. Certainly inflationary pressures on just normal day-to-day operational expenses are being experienced, you know, throughout all of our activities. But one of the things I'm also looking at are continuing to increase the village marketing events. We certainly had a rough first quarter with the atmospheric rain events, operating an outdoor shopping center, and having all of that weather played a role in seeing those numbers be a little bit down from what we would expect. And I think you see that in the departmental reports under leasing. One of the things I've asked marketing to do is increase above and beyond what we normally do, add more events and activities to help our tenants thrive and make up for some of those losses. So again, that'll be fleshed out a little bit more in the preliminary budget, but we're looking at some increases in some of their activities. Personnel changes, vacancies. We have very little vacancies. I think we have two that we'll be working on filling. Not a big number. Normal cost of living adjustments, or COLAs as we call them, labor agreements that are already in place that are multi-year agreements have increases baked into those agreements. Employee compensation and benefits, CalPERS. You're going to hear about that tonight a little bit more. And then just general liability insurance premiums. On the dredging side, which is not an operational expense, again, back to the atmospheric rain events, you've certainly heard us talk about the potential need for inner harbor dredging as opposed to the channel, which is the federal obligation. Inner harbor is our obligation. There is a dredging reserve fund that is maintained that's $3 million. It's $3 million that we maintain. And we are pursuing some FEMA funding to assist with that, since a lot of that was built up much more quickly than it normally is. And so that's something that we're pursuing to help offset those expenses. So we both have the dredging reserve fund to pull from. I think we're also looking at some operational revenues to pay for that, and then hopefully get some of that offset by FEMA. So we will see. And on to next slide, please. Okay, I'm going to stop there. We're going to talk more numbers later on, and again, some graphs and charts, but I'm going to at this time turn it over to Gloria, who's going to introduce Mary Beth Redding.
Good evening, everybody. Sounds like you pretty much all know Mary Beth, but we'll just talk about her a little bit here. She's with an actuary firm called Foster and Foster Consultants. They're a California actuarial firm that specializes in public agencies, pensions, and retire benefits. They analyze issues relating to CalPERS pensions and the projecting of future CalPERS rates. Mary Beth has been providing this update on the district's CalPERS obligations annually for us since 2017. Her presentation will include the background on CalPERS pension plans' unfunded liabilities, current status of the district's miscellaneous and safety plans. She will discuss where CalPERS rates are expected to go, and address options that could be implemented for funding the district's unfunded accrued liability, or the UAL, if the board chooses to go that direction. Mary Beth.
I got it. Okay, thank you, Gloria. 2017 sounds like a long time ago.
It does, but I looked it up.
And I have a slide in here from 2017, so it must have been the very first one. Okay, so it's our annual CalPERS review. A lot of this you might have heard before, but I know you guys only get to deal with it once a year, so I'm going to still walk you through everything. Let's go up to the next slide just to start with numbers. So this is a picture of historic CalPERS returns going back to the late 1990s. The blue line down the middle is the rate that CalPERS expects, expects to earn every year. And it's around 7%. It's been varying over time from a little above to a little below. Okay, so when CalPERS is better than the blue line, it's a good year. When they're worse than the blue line, it's a bad year. So even if they earn 4%, that's not a good year. That's a bad year because it's less than 7. So the green line with all the little dots in it is showing the returns for each fiscal year. They're up and down as all investment charts go up and down. But what you'll see in the middle of this one is 2008 and 9. That was a really, really bad period for CalPERS. And that is the root of a lot of what we are still suffering through today. I also want to draw your attention to the two dots at the far right. I think that the high one right around 21%, we probably knew last year when I was here, CalPERS's posted return for fiscal 21 was 21.3%. And then fiscal 22 came in when you finally got the final numbers in November at minus 7.5%. Those two almost exactly offset each other. They're about the same distance above and below the blue line. What we're looking at so far this year, it looks like they're running around a little better than 3% for the fiscal year. So a lot can happen in 6 weeks. We've found that out in the past couple of years. But probably it'll be a slightly bad year, not a disastrously bad year. The other thing I do want to point out is the I don't know what color they are, brown or red dots there are tracking the 10-year rolling average return, which in the past few years has dropped 2008 and 9 out of it. So it's come over the expected return. And the 20 and the 30-year returns are also over the 6.8. They're at 6.8 and 7.6%. So there is a sense if you talk to people that CalPERS never hits their target return. That's not actually true. They actually are averaging a little bit above it, but still the bad years are really driving a lot of what we're dealing with. Can I have the next slide? And part of that, we'll just say this kind of quickly, is their old policy, which was to try to smooth contributions for public agencies, to not make their rates go up really sharply in response to bad years. And they developed this policy that had a lot of smoothing in it. It did great at smoothing rates, but it did really, really badly at getting the unfunded liability paid off. Okay, the next slide. The other thing that's going on a lot around California is this thing called enhanced benefits. In the early 2000s, a lot of plans were overfunded and agencies responded by increasing the benefits. And that added a lot of cost, even though there was this rumor that this would never cost anything, it did. And those few agencies who did not do enhanced benefits, such as this district, are really in a much better position for not doing that. We also have the PEPRA tier now. It's for many agencies, it's running half of their people, not so much here. But this is all the people who have been hired after 2013. Those people are paying half of the cost of their benefits. They have limits on pay. They have a little lower benefit formula. They are really helping to stabilize costs at this point. You have to look really closely, but you can see it. Okay, next slide.
Mary Beth, can you remind me real quick? PEPRA stands for?
Public Employees Pension Reform Act. But it's just a nice thing to say, PEPRA people. It's kind of fun. Okay. Okay. We have the wrong heading on this slide, but that's okay. So the other thing that's going on a lot in California and the whole world is demographics. We see at most agencies, the liability and the assets that is assigned to the retirees is becoming bigger and bigger and bigger portion of the total. Part of that's because number of active employees is really being held level or even declining a lot of places, but the number of retirees is growing and growing and growing. We're not at a steady state yet. And so as you get more and more retirees and half again as many retirees as actives or twice as many retirees as actives, you just have this big pool of money that belongs to people who are not working for you, have nothing to do with the district anymore, but they have this big pool of assets. And when that pool of assets loses money, you have to pay for it. And so it becomes bigger relative to your whole budget and can just really has a leveraging impact on your costs. The good news for, and I should say, this isn't bad, right? This is a pension plan. It's meant to pay benefits to retirees. We like retirees, but they do cause this volatility, and you just have to be aware that it can happen. The district, partly due to the lower benefits, not adopting the enhanced benefits, has a little bit lower retiree liability percentage than most public agencies across the state, and safety significantly less. And so that's a really good thing that helps stabilize your costs a little bit. Okay, next slide, please. Okay, so CalPERS has been making changes over time to try to get back on track. They've made a bunch of changes that they got rid of all their smoothing. They've started to say new pieces of unfunded liability have to get paid off a lot faster. They've lowered their discount rate to try to have a better estimate of what their funds will earn in the future. All of these changes mean that there's a better estimate, really, of what we're going to owe for pensions. Better in this case means higher, and that means more cost to the employers. I have the next slide. We probably went through this last year, but I think it's really interesting to keep reminding people of. In November of 21, so a year and a half ago now, the board, CalPERS board, re-looked at how it wanted to be investing its assets. They wanted to hit 6.8%. They had been expecting 7%. They needed to lower that. Their advisors said returns are not going to be what they used to be. They're going to be lower. So to keep it 6.8%, they had to make the portfolio more risky. And if you look in the right-hand column, you can see that there's money in private debt that didn't used to be there. Private equity is larger than it used to be. And they have this category called leverage, which means that CalPERS is actually intending to borrow 5% of the fund and invest that to try to make more money. So in essence, I think of it as they're doing a little mini pension obligation bond. All of this makes, hopefully will pay off in the long run, but it means that we expect to have more really good and really bad years of investment returns, so more volatility going forward. Okay, that's the background on CalPERS. Really nothing new or changed since a year ago, except maybe the news that this year's returns are not looking particularly good, but not awful. Okay, looking at just the miscellaneous plan now, this is just some demographic information. We don't, because of the way CalPERS reports, we don't have everything back before 2012 for people in the risk pools, which includes your plan. But right now, now being June 30th of 2021, you had 27 employees covered by CalPERS at that point. You had, in the bottom section of that top graph, you had 21 people who used to work for the district and don't anymore. Typically, they have very little benefits, and we usually don't even bother thinking about them. And then you have 28 retirees. How that splits out between Classic and PEPRA, by headcount, you had 63% Classic, 37% PEPRA. Most agencies we're seeing are more like 50-50 by headcount at this point. Meaning your people are stable, they haven't been turning over as fast. By payroll, even a little more Classic because your PEPRA are the newer hires, so they're going to be paid less. Nothing surprising there. The little bit slower transition to moving into PEPRA kind of indicates there is more cost savings in your future that you haven't seen yet. Okay, next slide. This is a picture of the unfunded liability. There's two sets of bars or columns for each year. So on the left, you've got a multicolored column that's the actuarial liabilities, the value of benefits earned to date as of June 30th, 2020. And the green bar next to it is the amount of assets at CalPERS. You were 75% funded, $3.3 million underfunded. By 2021, with the great asset return, it had moved up to 84% funded. The unfunded had dropped to 2.2. So that's what we we knew were predicted last year. And then with the minus 7.5%, it's dropped down to 73% funded, and we estimate a $3.7 million unfunded liability. That'll be published usually in August. So pretty much back to where you were 2 years ago. The next slides are going to be some projections of costs, and all I want to say about the assumptions is that we factor in everything we know, including the 7.5% return that's not in the reports you have right now. And we do some modeling of assets because CalPERS isn't exactly symmetrical, and when you have good years, they do some things to pull the return down, so they don't balance out. So we really have to do some modeling that includes good and bad years to kind of show you where we think rates will go. Okay, next slide. So I wanted to start with this picture. The green line is where we're projecting the most likely rates right now, and they are peaking out at about 35%. They're starting with, can't read from there. I didn't bring my glasses in.
It looks like 34.6.
34.6 at the peak, and I think we're at like 24 right now on the left-hand side, if I remember right. What's interesting, though, is the blue line underneath. That is where rates would have been if CalPERS had not earned minus 7.5%, but if they had earned the 6.8 that they expect. Just in 1 year, the difference in those two lines is kind of 8 or 9% of pay. It's a really big number. So if they earn the same amount over expected, which they're probably not going to do this year, you would see that blue line flip up, not quite as much up as the downs. They're sort of biased to the bad years. But you can see that a year or two that's really good or a year or two that's really bad could have a huge impact on your costs, meaning it's really hard to, I'm going to tell you where I think rates are going to go, but I'm going to be wrong. Okay. So with that, let's go to the next slide. This is a 10-year projection of where we think the miscellaneous rates will be. I was wrong. They're 23% this year, 25% of pay next year. What I mean by 25% of pay is that for every dollar of pensionable payroll, which is pretty much most of your payroll, 25 cents gets shipped off to CalPERS. Wait, go back. As we go out, that rate is increasing. Even though that green line looks kind of flat, it's up to 35% of pay 10 years out. So it's a big increase even relative to pay. The little numbers above and below the line, I told you we do some modeling, some simulation of where investment returns could be. The green line is showing you where they're most likely to be. They're not going to be there, but they're most likely to be around the green line. 25% of the time, well, let me explain it this way. 50% of the time when we do our simulations, the rates come out between the little number above the graph and the little number below the graph. So in year 33, 34, half of the time we get a rate somewhere between 20% of pay and 44% of pay. Half of the time, quarter of the time we get a rate higher than 44% of pay. Quarter of the time it comes out lower than 19. So there's a huge amount of projected variability in the rates these days. Every time we do the modeling, it comes out wider and wider because they're doing more risky assets. Okay, next slide, please. So this is a 30-year projection. It looks a little more curvy because we've kind of had to squish it to put 30 years where we only had 10 years in the last slide, but it's the same numbers on the left. What you can see is that 10 years is kind of the peak. After that, it starts dropping down. The reason it's dropping down is hopefully most of the unfunded liability is getting paid off because you've been sending CalPERS a lot of money. Okay. It didn't just happen. It happened because you're making very large payments. Eventually, hopefully, the unfunded liability is pretty much paid off around 2044. We're down to pretty much just normal costs, the cost of benefits being earned about 9.5% of pay. That's a great world. The unfunded liability is paid off. All the classic people have retired. We have only PEPRA people who are paying more of the cost of their benefits, and everything's wonderful. But it's not guaranteed, of course. Next slide, please. This is the one. I dug this up. It's back from 2017, so many, many years ago. And I just wanted to look at it and compare it to what we're projecting now. And first of all, say, well, we had been projecting, if on the left, this increase and drop in costs, you're paying off the side fund that came and went. But if you look at the numbers really closely, it back many years ago, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, including the money the district was paying at that time towards the employee contributions, EPMC. Yeah, that was back then. We had been projecting rates at about 27.5% of pay in the peak years. And now we're projecting much higher than that, more like 37, 35-ish. So things have come out worse than we expected, and actually close to those little boxes on the top of this chart, close to the bad case scenarios. 6 years ago, people probably thought we were crazy predicting rates to go up this much. And I wish we were, but we weren't. So that's kind of interesting history. The other thing I did want to show you, though, is that if you look at this chart, it doesn't have that flat tail on the end the way this year's does. And that's because CalPERS, part of getting their house in order, getting everything in order, is they've shortened up the amount of time where you pay off unfunded liabilities. Things are getting paid over 20 years and not 30 years now. They're not dragging out so far. You're not paying up so much interest, but you can kind of think of it, right? If you take something you used to pay over 30 years and now you pay it over 20 years, you have to pay more. So that's part of the reason why the rates are higher in the short run. Okay, enough. I'll go real quickly through the rest of the slides. This is just breaking down the rates in terms of the normal cost, the percent of pay of benefits people are earning every year, about 10%, the peachy colored line. The red line is the unfunded liability line, really driving the increases in your costs. Next slide. Safety, I'm going to do really quickly. It's a smaller plan. You have 11 active safe sworn safety members, 5 who've left, and 8 retirees. And even more than with miscellaneous, close to 3/4 of your people are still classics and about 1/4 PEPRA. That's a little more typical for safety. Safety people don't change jobs as much as miscellaneous people do. Next slide. Looking at the unfunded liability, same pattern as we saw for miscellaneous. It was great last year and not so good this year, about to where it was 2 years ago. We're projecting about $1.3 million unfunded liability at June 30th of 22. Next. Same kind of pattern we saw for miscellaneous. A huge change in the rates if CalPERS had only earned 6.8% this year and not minus 7.5%. Next slide. Okay, so people, if you brought this chart to the city, they would be so jealous. The safety rates are about 27% of pay now. In 10 years, they'll be up to about 37%. Even though that's a lot, it is very different than what other agencies are paying, particularly ones with a large safety retiree population and who went and granted the large benefit increases. But the district isn't faced with all of those changes, so your rates are much more manageable than we see elsewhere. Next slide. 30-year picture is kind of the same, a little more exaggerated. Rates peak in the sort of mid 2030s, eventually we pay off the liability. It comes down to a long-term rate of about 13% of pay. The cost of benefits, the safety benefits, are a little more expensive than miscellaneous benefits. Next slide. Same picture, don't really need to talk about it. You can see the normal cost is level to dropping as we get more PEPRA members. And then finally, we should have the chart that adds together and turns it from rates into dollars that may be easier for the board to relate to. We think your total CalPERS bill for this fiscal year is about $650,000, about the same next year, but then we project it to steadily increase and almost double over the next 10 years to close to $1.2 million by 33-34. Part of that increase is coming from increase in rates, and part of it's just inflation on payroll. Okay, that's sort of the end of the numbers. We'll talk concepts now. So what are your options for dealing with this unfunded liability? Altogether, we're projecting about $5 million unfunded liability at June 30th of 22. We won't know for sure until the reports come out in the summer. But you really have three options. One is to just pay your CalPERS rates as they're billed. And if the numbers we're showing you are feasible, you don't have to do anything else. There's nothing wrong with just waiting to get the bill from CalPERS and paying it every year. The rates could be lower, could be higher. You do have the choice of making additional payments to CalPERS. We'll talk about that in a second. Or the third choice is setting aside funds in something called a 115 trust. Next slide. And just to remind you, again, I know I can't tell you too many times. It depends so much on what CalPERS actually earns. If they earn 6.8% for fiscal 23, we think the unfunded will stay at about $5 million. But if they earn zero, it'll be up to $6 million. So if I'm guessing right and it's about 3%, it'll be sort of $5.5 million.
That's a combination of both the safety and miscellaneous.
Safety and miscellaneous together, yes. Okay. So talking through the options of what you can do, one is to make extra payments to CalPERS. There's really two options. Option one is this thing called Fresh Start, where you tell CalPERS, I don't want to be paying off my liability over 20 years. I want to pay it off over, I don't know, 10 years. And they say, great, we will change your payment plan. You'll pay more for the next several years, but you'll be done in 10 years. The problem is you have to lock into that and you can't undo it. So nobody... Okay. I saw the CalPERS people give their presentation to their board, and they asked how many people had done it. And I saw the kind of go not very many. I think he was up to like four. People don't like this option. If you really want that payment pattern, you can do it yourself without locking in. The second and much, much more popular option is to make additional discretionary payments. It's a new word for just sending CalPERS extra money. When you do that, they pay off a piece of the unfunded liability. The problem is, as I see it, that probably, well, the good thing is this is really easy to do. You send them a check and you're done. You don't have to worry about it. Probably what you wanted to do was keep on making the same contributions that were scheduled, but just have your unfunded paid off sooner. That's not the way it works. So CalPERS takes your extra payment, and then when they do their next actuarial valuation, they say, oh, look at that. We have more money than we thought we were going to. You don't have to pay as much. And so they reduce your payments every year in the future. And that means they're kind of like spending that extra money over the next 10 or 15 or 20 years. You're still saving a lot of money in interest. You're not getting the unfunded paid off a lot faster. And again, just always have to remind everyone, there's no guaranteed savings that you could give CalPERS this money and they could have a -7.5 year or a -30 year or who knows what. Okay, next slide, please. The 115 trust is very different. It's a separate trust. There's CalPERS has set up one. Some private sector companies have set up trusts. For an agency your size, you would want to invest with one of those. It's too expensive to do it yourself, but they'll hold your money. And the only thing you can do with the money in this trust is use it to pay CalPERS. But the draw of these is the investments are much less restricted than keeping money at the district. You can invest it in stocks and bonds or anything that you think is fiduciarily responsible. And you have total control over that money. You have control over when that money goes in or if it goes in, and then you have total control over when it comes out. You can take the money out and send it to CalPERS, or if you have paid CalPERS yourself in the past year, you can reimburse yourself. So it's a very flexible kind of fund, and I think because it's so flexible, the auditors don't really like it, and it doesn't count as an asset for your financial statements. People who do these are usually thinking one of two things. One, just building up a big pile of money that eventually they'll give to CalPERS and pay off their unfunded. But they're not really ready to give up total control of that money yet. So they're not ready to turn it over to CalPERS. They might need it. So they just build it up in the separate fund. Other people are trying to do this thing we call rate stabilization, which is put some money in the fund and kind of figuring that in years when the CalPERS rates are unexpectedly high, they'll pay some of that money out of the trust fund. And in years when maybe the rates are unexpectedly low, they'll take some of the money they had been budgeting and build up the trust fund. So trying to help stabilize the impact of CalPERS on their budget. Some people are doing this kind of scientifically, and some people are doing it kind of randomly. Random is probably a little more common at this point, you know, meaning that, oh, I have some money left at the end of the year, let's put it in the Section 115 trust. And those people are looking at getting money that's maybe like 1 year's worth of contributions. So for you right now, that's $600,000, looking at a million 10 years out. But if you can kind of see that if you had that kind of money in a trust fund, you could feel really comfortable dealing with unexpected increases or decreases in the CalPERS rates. It would, you know, less than that would still be helpful. Everything's helpful. So when you compare the two options, so the question I'm always asked is, which one should we do? Most agencies don't make the choice in any kind of scientific or numerical or calculated way. Okay. We think that it's usually very subjective. Supplemental trust, very flexible. CalPERS, very locked in. Why would you want to lock yourself in? Some people say, I don't trust the boards or councils that come after me. They might use that money when they shouldn't. They might not use that money when they should. You know, they might lay off a ton of employees instead of just using that money. We don't trust them. The supplemental trust probably has a lower long-term return. CalPERS probably has a higher long-term return. CalPERS, you don't get an investment choice. Supplemental trust, you do. If you really want that money to be available, you see, I don't know, a recession coming. You could invest that money very conservatively. We talked about the differences for accounting. The supplemental trust is really visible. If you're collecting money from your ratepayers, your property taxes, you want to be able to account for that money and show people what it's, you know, built up to. You can see that in your supplemental trust. If you give it to CalPERS, it kind of gets mixed in with the rest of the CalPERS money. It's really hard to say what it ended up, you know, if it ended up being a plus or a minus. So those are all the considerations. But I do want to say again, there's, as long as you look at out at your rates, you know what they're going to be, and you're comfortable, you can deal with them. You don't have to do things. It saves you interest in the long run, but there's costs to setting aside money to do this. Did I have a slide after that? I think that was the end. Oh. We didn't talk about where you might come up with money. Not my specialty, but it might be money that you budget, either just put into your budget as every year, or you might have a board resolution that says when we have money at the end of the year, this is how we're going to use that money. And one of those uses would be towards pensions. So sort of one-time funds. Some agencies are asking their employees to help pay more towards their share of pensions. You can get some extra money. It's really hard to ask your employees to pay more than a couple percent of pay. So, you know, you're looking at a 10% of payroll increase in pay costs. I don't think you're going to get your employees to kick in 10% of pay, but it can help. And then pension obligation bonds were very popular for a couple of years when rates were very low, but I think that ship has sailed. That was my last slide. Questions?
Just a quick one. I believe one of the commissioners asked this last time you were here, which is that 75% unfunded for on average. I know yeah. We've gone up and down. Where does that sit in terms of the average for similarly situated agency?
Vice Chair, did you say funded or unfunded?
I'm sorry, the unfunded. Thank you.
It's actually the 75% is actually percent funded.
Funded.
It's Safety, it's very much better than average. Mm-hmm. And miscellaneous, it's a little better than average.
Okay.
You're just in, you're in a much better position than many, many other agencies are.
Thank you.
And just a follow-up question. I just wanted to make sure I understand, Mary Beth. So we are making every year a payment towards the unfunded liability.
Yes.
And that amount is dictated to us by CalPERS.
Yes.
And it's intended that those payments would pay off the unfunded liability in 20 years?
They used to be funding over 30 years, so you still have some pieces that are probably at 24, 25 years, but all the new pieces are 20 years.
Okay. And then did I understand correctly that, not in your presentation tonight, but at a recent city meeting, does the city of Ventura shoot for about an 80% funding level? And it may not be as simple as just throwing that percentage out, but is that sort of a goal that they have looked to? And obviously you could be 85% 1 year, have CalPERS have a very poor return, and you've done nothing different but make the payments you were obligated to make and go from 85 to 75 as yes. an example?
Yep.
Okay.
I think the city of Ventura, I don't want to, the equivalent of putting words in their head, you know, sort of make up to myself what they were thinking when they targeted 80%. There is a popular sentiment going around that we should only fund public plans to 80%, that's good enough. I think the feeling is that if you have plan funded to 80% and then your funded ratio drops, you can always just raise taxes and get more money. That's the public perception. We know it's not that easy. And that's one of the reasons why actuaries and most people really recommend targeting 100%, because we have bad years. I mean, all these plans used to be 150% funded. Things happen. But my guess is that Ventura set the 80% target as a place where if they're not at 80%, they want to be kicking in more money, you know, rather than saying that's our ultimate goal of being 80. But that's our marker for where we should be taking action.
Thank you.
At least you end up like San Bernardino or Detroit. Some of the cities, what they basically did is when they had extra money, instead of, for lack of a better word, buying down their UAL, they basically said, oh, the rates are good. We won't pre-fund. The other thing is a lot of us thought that we could use these things called ARPA money to pay this down. But unfortunately, they were on to us and they basically said you can't use any of the money for that. The pension obligation bonds, I remember about 15 or 20 years ago, the GFOA was vehemently against that. And then coming back to California, I see it was a real big thing. But now that interest, the returns on that, basically what a pension obligation bond is you basically issue debt and then you take the proceeds of that to pay down your UAL on the presumption that you'll have less payments over the life of it. But as you said, the timing and everything for that. So we do have a lot of options that, you know, I think we should be looking at. It's just amazing that people don't realize that to have a workforce, especially municipalities, that this is a very, very big piece of the cost, that if you're just paying everything, when you do your revenue projections and everything and you're just paying, it may suddenly go up. And unfortunately, a lot of public entities get into trouble. Oh, you mismanage your funds. No, it's the economy, stupid. CalPERS may have they've been through, they've got some new actuaries. So this is a challenging area. And I think we'll have some, with the advice from our finance and yourself and our management, we'll have some choices to make in order to make sure that we do something that I would say that is well thought out, and that later on, when you make a decision like this as to whether how you're going to go about funding it, you want it so that 4 or 5 years ago, people in the governance understand the rationale behind what was decided. And the last thing, as you say, it all depends on the top and the bottom of those returns.
This question actually for Gloria. How do we pay CalPERS? Do they bill us monthly, annually?
At the beginning of the year, they gave me an unfunded liability, unfunded accrued liability amount. And so we pay that in July, and that saves us $10,000 to $11,000 in interest. We pay it all up front in July. But then every single paycheck, we have to pay them contributions based on the wages. And that is paid every single paycheck. Probably about $20,000 a paycheck.
Okay.
So it's the UAL that's the payment.
Right,
but again, we're saving money because we don't spread it out over the fiscal year or pay it at the end of the fiscal year. We pay it at the beginning, so we're saving some money.
Correct. We save the interest from the year, which is, again, about $10,000 to $11,000. This year, we'll be paying $335,000, but we can take $10,000 off of that because we're going to pay for it up front instead of depending on hoping to earn interest on that money ourselves.
And this idea of a supplemental trust, I think we've debated this in prior years. We do not do that.
We do not.
Yeah, we've asked Mary Beth to, each time she comes, you know, remind the current composition of the board of what some of those options are. By her introducing it, we're not suggesting that you should take one of those options or increase, but understand that those are things available to the district. In particular, the idea of locking in additional payments above those that we are required to pay to CalPERS and agreeing to that and then being locked into that forevermore is not something I've ever recommended to the board. Mm-hmm. The idea of us investing in the stock market, would not recommend that either. So from my perspective, I did ask Mary Beth to just kind of look at the city's policy with respect to the 80%. But again, it's you're chasing something because of this. We currently are over 80%.
In 2021.
Right, which is, that sounds old, but that's the most recent, that's the most current information that
actually
we have,
published. Yeah.
It's published. So we exceed those thresholds, I think, in every category, didn't we?
I think you do.
Yeah. So miscellaneous, safety, both classic and PEPRA. So from the perspective of what's published today, if we looked at it relative, you know, broadly speaking, to an 80% funded level, we exceed that. So CalPERS now has a less than stellar year at possibly, you know, we'll see, 3-4%. We go from exceeding that particular metric that the city's using to not meeting it, but not by anything that we've done or not done, right? So do we want to chase that and go, well, we're less than 80%, you know, in theory, I guess, then the market has a good year the next year and we're at 88%. I mean, so it's very difficult to sort of, I think to your point about it, it's hard to be sort of kind of metric focused on a specific plan of trying to further write that down when you're chasing numbers that are all over the place. But from my perspective, us having any ongoing say in where we would take money and put it into investments I have seen that go very poorly with other public agencies and would not recommend that to this board. And again, the idea of locking in additional payments to CalPERS with no flexibility, there's the old expression of cash is king, and I think the district's better positioned to have its reserves and its monies available to itself and make a determination if it wanted to make any additional payments. So again, we always ask her to introduce the topic. You're not making any decisions here tonight about anything related to the budget, but I think it's a really interesting discussion.
But what you're introducing is, as we develop our 23-24 budget, there is this opportunity to come back and say, well, let's add those extra payments, or let's pursue the supplemental trust, or pursue some of the other things that you recommend we don't consider. But
sure.
But that's the whole reason for the brief, right?
Is exactly.
Those things are out there for consideration.
Right. And we're sort of, you know, obviously talking to an expert here, but we actually don't have those numbers yet. I mean, the numbers we have demonstrate that we have an unfunded UAL to make, as do most agencies. But if we sort of compare it as you did, like, well, how are we relative to other agencies? And then that's why I sort of introduced the metric of an 80% number that the city's using. And again, right now we exceed it. We could have this discussion next year, and based on the numbers that come out in roughly August, if they don't hit their number, we could be below it. So if you sort of tied it to something specific like that, then I would recommend no change this year, but we'd have to look at it again next year. So it's a little bit of a challenge there. I guess the only thing that you're doing by advancing cash is, in theory, you're reducing your interest costs.
You're reducing your interest cost, and I think when you look at, I don't know Ventura specifically, but when you look at a lot of the large older cities that have, you know, been providing police and fire forever, you're looking at their safety rates of close to 100% of pay projected or more. Miscellaneous rates, probably well over 50%. So the just when they look into the future, they say, we don't see how we're going to be able to afford to pay these rates. We have to do something. It's a very different position than I understand the district to be in.
Right. We look at those increasing rates, and we have to ensure that we have enough revenue to pay those increasing rates, but it's not those astronomical bills that you just talked about.
Yeah.
If we got several employees in the room, from their perspective, I mean, we're talking budgets and how do we balance our next year's budget. From an employee perspective, it's really, is CalPERS healthy? That's what that's what they're concerned about, right?
Right. And CalPERS has lots of money. They have lots and lots of money. They have plenty of money to pay all the retirees. They will have enough money. You shouldn't worry at all that the money is not going to be there for your pension. It will be. It's just a little bit of how much of a struggle is it going to be for particularly some agencies to make that happen. But the money will be there.
Yeah, you're right. It really comes back to agencies like ours, the district, to keep funding those annual bills. And as us baby boomers continue to retire, that bill is going to continue for a while. I guess that's your 30-year curve, right? Eventually, it'll come down. But
yeah, CalPERS, the way they fund, I didn't really go into all the actuarial science, but the idea is that.
Thank you.
money is built up over an employee's career. As they earn pay, they pay this 20 or 30 or 40% of pay to CalPERS, so that at the point you retire, there is enough set aside to pay your pension. You're not, unlike Social Security, you're not waiting for the next generation to be kicking in money to pay your pension. Your funds for your pension are set aside by the time you retire.
Okay. That's a good clarification, and that's CalPERS is managing those investments, and that's why you don't want to pull that
back to the district. We don't want to become an investment bank.
No.
That's not our business. All right.
And if I could, I would just add that I'm basically awaiting your recommendation as to whether we should pursue something like this or doing something with a one-time capital or operating. I like this, but in terms of the priorities or the budget, I think that's something that I would wait for your recommendation on, as opposed to, you know, looking at this.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And just to give you a sense of historically, you could probably guess by the discussion, the recommendation has been to not change the methodology from which we make our payments up to this point. But again, we do bring it forward as a topic each year. So my recommendation to the board has been to obviously make the payment on the bill that we receive, make it at the beginning of the fiscal year, save a little bit of interest, and move on. So we'll see as we get through the budget process how we approach it this year. I appreciate that.
Before we let Mary Beth off the stage, open it up to the employees since we have several employees here. You guys got any questions? Yeah, trust CalPERS, right? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Where do we go from
here? Next slide. Okay, we're going to jump into proposed capital improvement projects, and I will turn it over to Joe Gonzalez, our capital projects manager.
Good evening, Chair and Commissioners. I'm going to highlight some of the projects in the 23-24 project proposed capital improvement budget. The primary budget that's going to be presented to the board on June 7th Commissioners meeting will be having further details. Staff has prioritized projects, as I will explain during this presentation. You have in the top there, we have the public boat launch ramp and also the washdown. So this project right here consists of ADA improvements for the washdown, as well as floating for the floaters for the docks as well. And below that, if you could recall, at my last meeting and the last commissioner's meeting, I brought up two restrooms that needed ADA improvement. Well, these are the two, 5059 and below is the 1583. Unfortunately, these restrooms cannot be ADA compliance due to the space contraints, but they will be refurbished with the new tiles and bring them up to speed, you know, bring them up to par. Reason being that these restrooms are tired and, you know, they just need refurbishment. And so that's the same thing with the 1583. And that includes also replacement of the cast iron pipes, which facilities are already having with little issues with the 5059 restrooms. And these are really busy restrooms. They're located at the Brophy's restaurant and by the Creek restaurant. So when these two completed, we're all refurbished all our restrooms. And these locations will also be in ADA compliance because we do have a family restroom at the 5059 location. And 1583 location, they could walk to the refurbished ones we just did at 1575. So they're still within the 200 feet permitted by ADA compliance. Next slide, please. Here we have the Harbor Village roof replacement. This is when we paralyzed the projects because this building here, we have 1575 and 1583 are the last two buildings to be re-roofed for the project. And these are the two biggest buildings we have. And to do the roof for this one, you're looking at about $1 million to do this. So to paralyze this restroom, we're going to go ahead and push it out, but we're not going to forget about these buildings here. 1575, we put in $100,000, and what this $100,000 is going to do is going to not put a Band-Aid on. So this $100,000 is not going to be a spend money. So basically what we're going to do, we're going to get the section of this building and waterproof it with all the warranties. So when we come back to this building, we'll do the other sections that was not doing. So basically we're just going to repair these sections of the restrooms that are giving up, the buildings that's giving problems to facilities right now with leaks and stuff like that. So we're going to just use this money to repair them. So when we come back to them, we'll continue on with the repairs and the replacement of the roof. Next slide, please. So here we have the EV stations. What it is we're committed to make the harbor green, and this is part of implementing the EV charging stations as we go along. Next, please. Next slide. And here we have the 1583 ADA path of travel. This is to connect the ADA courtyard into the promenade. And down below too, we actually, this one here, let me see the 1582, the wayfinding sandwich as well. Next slide, please. I'm sorry about that. And this is a significant increase on the tenant improvements. This one here is basically 1559, the old comedy club. And basically, we're just going to go ahead and put some more additional tenants' offices upstairs, and there's going to be an additional 5 offices included as well.
Thanks, Joe. Let me add a little bit here. So when we come back on the 7th, you'll see the full 5-year CIP. Tonight, what we were focused on is showing you what we'll be recommending for next fiscal year. You'll see that contextually with all 5 years. So when Joe was talking about roofs and restrooms, we're going to prioritize, our recommendation would be to prioritize completing all the restrooms next fiscal year. And then roof, the rest of the roof work on the buildings that he mentioned, which would be over $1 million, is estimated in cost. When we look at our numbers, doing all that restroom work and all that roof work in the same fiscal year, then the costs, as we see it, begin to exceed what we think we can handle in one fiscal year. So so that's where we're headed. We're headed in, get the restrooms completed, get the roofs completed in the following fiscal year, which would be, what, 24, 25. So that's sort of the meat of that discussion. There were a lot of other smaller projects, and I asked Joe to just kind of pick a few, but we can certainly go back and look at any of those if you'd like to. The TIs, again, we there's accounting reasons why, and then there's budgeting reasons why that we keep those separate from capital projects. Most of that work can't be capitalized in terms of accounting requirements, and we specifically identify, and you've seen that in the past, where we identify work that we've committed to in leases, work that we think we'll need to do to refresh office suites and other spaces throughout the village, in particular since we operate the village directly ourselves, and we have a significant expense. So when I sort of look at the restrooms, the roofs, we're looking at a very significant expense in the TIs, tenant improvements, that we don't normally see in a particular fiscal year. And that is all great work to be done to reposition that almost 4,000 square feet into new office space, a little bit by one of our restaurateurs, but the bulk of it will be for new offices. So that's going to take a lot of effort and a lot of expense to reposition all that that square footage. When that work's done, obviously we're in an opportunity where we can release that and get it back on the rent rolls and move forward. So when we're doing this budgeting and looking at all these different expenses, those are the two that we're going to focus on, the restrooms and the tenant improvement for the 4,000 feet plus some obligations and in-kind investment with a couple of our restaurants. And then we'll look at roofs at the next year. If I add all that up, my numbers start to not look as good.
I just want to make sure I understand the modernization of the 4,000 square feet of office space. Is that taking what is now the comedy club and converting it to office space?
It's taking what was the comedy club and converting it to office, yes.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yes, tense is very important. And just out of curiosity, because we believe that has a better ROI, we know that we can rent office space more easily than perhaps a business with that? Or
so with us gaining restaurant space where the Loose Cannon, which is the name of the new tenant who will be coming downstairs, recall that was only entertainment. It's going to be in both entertainment and food. From our perspective, the best way to position the suites upstairs is into office. So yeah, you can look at it from an ROI perspective. I think we also look at it from a balance of uses perspective in terms of the village. Mm-hmm. And we have a strong demand for office space.
Okay, so yeah. There is a strong demand. There's a waiting list. Is there going to be pizza? I'm desperate for there to be pizza at the harbor. So if that happened, that'd be
you know what? Maybe.
Thank you,
Ms.
Buck.
Yeah, but okay, it's slice.
Miss Snipe has just guaranteed you pizza. It's in the minutes. So, you know, it's hard to see because you're not seeing it relative to the whole five-year plan at this point. But the point is that we're constantly looking at all these different expenses as it relates to capital. And usually some of that comes from excess operating revenues or total revenues. But a portion of that generally comes from our reserves, right? And so then we have to, and you'll see the reserve analysis, but I'm just kind of trying to put it all together into a bigger picture for you.
Joe, I got a question about the roofs that you're deferring to next year, sure. not this budget, but the following. This past winter has been a stress test. How those roofs fare?
Yeah, correct. All the new rebuilds, all the re-roofers projects, they all went excellent. The only one that had trouble this year was with the 1575. That's the one we're putting $100,000 into to repair it, the parts that need to be repaired.
So you're confident that'll get us to the following year when we can do the complete refurbishment. Yeah. I worked in a building this year where after every rain I would go in and have to put blowers because the carpeting was saturated. Mm. And it's not pleasant.
No. So. Yeah. No. Any other questions on these? We have a couple more slides that Gloria's going to walk through. We can certainly come back to any of this. Okay. All right, the promised pie chart.
This is showing.
Yeah, you're good.
This is showing you where our revenues are coming from. This is based on fiscal year 21-22. You probably saw it when you went to the city as part of the city slideshow that Brian did. And as Brian said earlier, it's about 88% or more is self-generated income. So we really rely on keeping our tenants happy and good. The property taxes, about 12%. We're actually looking at about a 4% increase this year. And we've exceeded that for fiscal year 23. And so we're going to continue, try to boot 4%. And that is allocated to the public safety. It doesn't cover all of it, but it is allocated to public safety. So this is where our revenue is doing. If you go to the next slide. These are our revenue and expense outlooks. The purple are the expenses. Purple plus green is where the revenue is sitting. In 21-22, you can see the big gap there because in 21-22, we received grant monies, but we weren't ready to spend them. And so in the next fiscal year and after that, we'll be spending them. You see the expense going up where we're starting to spend those monies. After the completion of the capital tenant improvements in 23-24, we're thinking we're going to have about $2.7 million remaining in the capital improvement fund, and we'll have about $4.98 million will be set aside as that 40% unrestricted reserve that we want to keep as a safety net. And for the preliminary budget, this chart will go out 5 more years. We'll do a projection taking it out further. And that's what I've got, Brian.
Did you touch on bond covenants and requirements?
I did not. I did not.
Can you touch on that?
Certainly.
Briefly?
We have done the analysis and we have met or exceeded our bond covenant needs. And we always do that analysis to make sure that we're okay on that. So and we're good so far. We're actually really good. So.
Okay, that concludes our presentation. Like I said, we can go back to any of the slides if you like and open it up for your discussion.
Commissioners, other questions?
Just a really broad question. From in terms of revenues and expenditures, what's been the biggest driver? Has it been the weather? Has it been the, first everyone was saying, oh, COVID-19. Is there anything for this fiscal year that's affected?
So I think on the macro level, our revenues are actually exceeding projections. When I mentioned earlier that if you look in the departmental reports and you look at Q1, calendar year Q1, for this year, a portion of the village, a portion, reports sales to the Port District as part of their leases. There are many businesses within the village that are office tenants and so on, and they're not required to report sales to us. But from those that are required to report sales, we certainly have seen some decrease in the first quarter. So I referenced that earlier in terms of talking about wanting to make sure that we do everything we can do to support. We can't change the weather, but we can certainly support our tenants by putting on as many activities, doing as much outreach and advertising and marketing as so on. But on the macro level, we're actually exceeding our projected revenues for the current fiscal year as projected through March 31st.
Let me follow up on that. If we can go back, well, I guess, can we go back?
Yeah.
Do you know how to do it? Do you have the technology? When we look at that revenue forecast, how much risk do we see? That's it. That's the one. Yeah. What areas are there risk and how much risk? And as you reach out, you said you're getting forecasts from your master tenants, from the retailers in the village. Are they taking into account inflation, recession concerns, and how does that translate into risk here?
Yeah, I mean, it's qualitative and quantitative. And again, remember that sales are only but a portion of the revenue that is generated from the village, for example, right? We have base rents, we have common area maintenance, we have fees associated with refuse and so on, right? All of those are evaluated by our team in terms of looking at, what is the, I said it earlier, relative to the rent roll, right? So, every lease has a period of time, it has increases built into it, and we evaluate those. We also evaluate the fact that we have some vacancy because of changes that we just talked about, both in terms of the 4,000 square feet that needs to be reconfigured. And we have a lease with a lot of construction underway for the loose cannon, right? So those are both areas where we would hope to increase occupancy, although our occupancies, as you can see by our reports, are very high, right? So so that's part of the evaluation. We look at the rent roll. Mm-hmm. What is the rent roll? What are we making this year? Do we anticipate making next year? And the area that you have to sort of evaluate is on sales projections, right? For a portion of that Harbor Village revenue of $3.6 million, which was for fiscal year 21-22. Master tenants, many of the master tenants have minimum rents that they have to pay. Most well exceed those minimums by large amounts. Some of the things we look at there, for example, is Holiday Inn Express. The original building is at 69 rooms that have been offline for remodeling. In speaking to the general manager, the expectation is that those rooms will come back online by the end of the month. They're hoping by Memorial Day weekend. So those coming back online before even the beginning of the fiscal year means that summer season is ready to be captured by the entire 69 rooms that have been offline. So recall they added 40 rooms. That's the new building. Mm-hmm. And then they went back and started remodeling these rooms. So, I mean, those are the kinds of conversations that you can't just get from staring at a spreadsheet, right? And then we look at, I mentioned Water Pure. I mean, I think the ones that are concerned are going to be your directors and your port sides who are in the direct path of that project. Most of the revenue coming from port side today actually comes from the residential a portion of the project, not the commercial. I think we've talked a little bit about, well, you know, what if I feel like, well, I'll go live somewhere else maybe for a year and come back when it's all, you know, redone. Kind of hard to know, but I think in talking with the developer there, he feels pretty good about his stabilized income on the whole. I think the area of concern there is going to be probably more so for the commercial areas. Right now, that's not generating much revenue for the district anyway, so we don't really have a big number to plug in there. I mean, it's those kinds of discussions that take us through those analyses. It's both quantitative and qualitative. A lot of other uses are somewhat stable. Things like the mobile home park, they don't really dramatically go up or down, recession or not. And we have marinas with pretty high occupancy rates, including our own, which is the commercial marina, with waiting demand for that marina. So on the whole, again, revenues are coming in a little bit higher than projected. There's always going to be a future recession. It's just what year is it going to occur, right? So I think, you know, none of us are going to predict a recession. So we have to be, and I think we continue to be fairly conservative in our assumptions, and we usually, fortunately, have come out a little bit ahead of those projections, both in terms of revenues and generally a little bit less on expenses.
Good question. Grants, with the fun things that are happening with the federal government on the debt ceiling, federal grants, and with the state of California now predicting a significant reduction in revenues, could that impact our future grants in any way?
It certainly could, but again, we have not projected grant revenues that we have not received.
Okay.
So in the projections that you'll see in the preliminary budget in terms of gross numbers, they're not going to be there.
Okay.
So we hope to achieve those, and we would love to be back here in front of the board asking the board to accept additional grant monies. But it's a great question. We just don't want to put something in there that we don't have a letter saying it's yours.
All right.
You know, but I think you're right. I mean, I think both at the state level and federal level, you know, monies at the state level, right, they went from a surplus to what is a projected deficit. So is there going to be a lot of extra money out there for things? There still could be monies allocated for certain things that relate to ports and harbors, and we'll continue. Ms. Snipes and Mr. Mitchell continue to look very closely at those. John Higgins, our harbor master, looks at those related to public safety, and as a team as a whole, we pursue those where we think they make sense.
Again, a quick follow-up, and then Jackie, I'll turn it over to you. If we go to the next slide that showed that one. Mm-hmm. A lot of discussion about the federal government pulling back COVID grant money that wasn't used. Are we susceptible to that?
We could certainly bring a report back on that. I think a lot of what you've been seeing in terms of the results of projects that the board talked about earlier tonight, and you've seen in the reports, a lot of that has been matching monies from those grant monies. So we've been actively spending those. I could probably bring a report back that shows how much, what percentage of that and dollar amounts are expended. I don't think we're at any risk of losing those funds.
I've been thinking about the effect of climate change and the increased costs related to that. Have we been tracking increased costs related to weather events, the king tides, increased winds, the atmospheric river? We're having a monsoon, expected rains here in the San Gabriel Mountains 2 months ahead of schedule. Clean up the boat replacement because of the tsunami. Have we been tracking that so that we can project in some way?
I don't know if we've bundled it as a climate related or weather related. I mean, we've certainly have had a variety of things, right? Some of this damage was tsunami from a volcano eruption, you know, how many thousands of miles away from here, right? To the weather conditions now. So in terms of the weather-related impacts, probably two things. One, The board approved additional monies as part of the mid-year budget, and we've applied for federal assistance with specific dollar amounts in those. So we have that data and those numbers.
I was thinking specifically just any increased cost over and above what we would consider regular maintenance or CIP projects kind of thing, because it seems to me that this is going to become the new normal. So understanding kind of a annual amount that a resiliency reserve that we need or should anticipate.
Yeah, I think challenging, right? I think that's one of the reasons this chart isn't the one that you'll see next time, which also shows the 40% reserve and then the amounts above the 40% reserve. I mean, I think you've sort of learned I'm pretty conservative in budgeting. That difference between the 40% and that additional amount is basically additional capital reserves. In essence, those are the monies that we have available when these things happen. And so you can put a number on it in terms of understanding budgetarily that we're meeting, not only are we meeting our reserve requirements, we have projected by staff, you know, X number of million dollars in addition to that. I would call that, you know, basically additional emergency reserve fund. I mean, that's not what its name is, but right. In essence, that's what it is. The other ones, remember, I mentioned it earlier, is the $3 million reserve that we maintain for dredging. Mm-hmm. And that's for any dredging. And so when we talked about the atmospheric rain events and the additional buildup of silt and sand, we have to maintain the $3 million, but we're allowed to spend the $3 million. So it's there not just to be a number on a page. It's A, it's real money, and B, we can spend it. We have to replenish it. Mm-hmm. And I think if I'm right, Gloria, we have to replenish it by the next fiscal year. So if we spend $500,000, we need to budget $500,000 to bring that back up. So that's, I mean, those are probably two areas that we have. There's some things that we are doing that I've asked facilities, Sergio and his team, is to put more monies into some of this beach sand clearance and so on, to your point. Mm-hmm. Just knowing that what we dealt with this year is probably not going away, or it could be something else that we get impacted by. So I really wanted to make sure that there is funds within his budget for things like, you know, tractors and, you know, cleanup and debris removal, those kinds of things. What kind of number to put on it? It's a little bit hard to put a specific one on it. I mean, ultimately, it's those additional reserves that we would come back to and say, we need to spend some of that additional reserve down. It doesn't put you in any danger of going below the 40% unless we had a truly catastrophic event, in which then we would absolutely be in front of FEMA looking for reimbursements.
And it seems to me there's both increased expenses and the potential for lost income, like we saw with the Harbor Village experience mm-hmm. with the atmospheric river. So trying to account for both, I think it would be helpful to have projections of what an increase in weather-related expenses or lost income might be.
Why don't we give that some thought, and we'll bring something back. On the one hand, it's really challenging. On the other hand, On the other hand, you could throw a percentage at it and say, you know, if your total operational expenses, you know, in theory, that's what the 40% is for. So it's like, okay, are we unofficially setting aside an even bigger number because of that? You know, the 40% is there for just that eventuality occurring. What the district has benefited from is the ability to absorb these costs and also seek reimbursement from both state and federal governments, in which we've never dropped below that 40%. But in theory, you could spend, that's what that 40% is right. for. It is a board policy to maintain that in the event of a loss of revenue or increase of costs or some combination thereof due to all of these different things you just mentioned.
I think it's beyond the budget. It's just, for me, a helpful talking point and understanding of the increased expenses and costs related to climate change overall.
Like I said, maybe give us a little bit of time to kind of think that through a little bit.
This is a crazy one. With the climate change and everything, is that going to affect our need for dredging in the future? And if so, is that an absorbable cost within our regular budget?
So, great question, actually, not a crazy one, because we have two different issues with what you just said, and two different sets of funding with what you just said. So the entrance channel is a federal obligation, but as soon as I finish that sentence, we always start the next sentence with, and we have to continue to advocate and educate Congress to make sure that they continue to prioritize Ventura in their core funding for maintenance, harbor maintenance, and in this case, that maintenance being specific to the dredging activity. So that number, if you recall, tends to be somewhere in the nature of 5 to 6 million a year, can be more. I think you heard Todd talk about a potential $8 million presidential budget allocation to Ventura. So that would be even more money if Congress approves that as well, that would be available. So my understanding, this goes back many years. There was a year in which there was not full funding, maybe I think a decade or more or so ago, and the district did use, I believe, some of its funds to make up for some of that shortfall. So that's why you hear the importance of continually advocating for federal funding to meet their own obligation for the federal entrance channel. The Inner Harbor dredging is not a federal project. And so anything that maintains navigational safety within the harbor is the district's obligation. Now, to maybe both your points, that used to be about an every 5 or 6 year, maybe 5 year or so activity. We just did that 3 years ago, and we'll need to do it again. And a lot of that has to do with, again, the atmospheric rain events. So the $3 million is a obligated monies that are set aside for that. I think we're estimating somewhere in the nature of about $500,000 or so for Inner Harbor dredging next year. And again, we're hoping we could recover some of that from FEMA, if not all of it. But in the meantime, we're budgeting monies for that, at least half of them, half of that expense from the $3 million, I believe, and I think the other half from operational revenues. How does that change over time? I think it's you know, again, it's important that that $3 million is there for that very event. And can continue to know that, that the timing of those Inner Harbor dredgings could increase potentially. So, which is maybe why I'm not usually into sending more money to CalPERS. I know you'll await for that recommendation, but again, cash on hand is always helpful.
So looking ahead to our next budget session, a couple of things that I'll be looking for is commercial fishing. It's the primary justification we have for dredging the harbor, dredging that entranceway, and so it's critical. And you talked earlier tonight about how that's up and down. So how do we stabilize that commercial fishing fleet? We made major investments in the piers, and that was a good investment. What else can we do to stabilize our fishing fleet? Certainly the potential partnership with Wainimi and moving their fishing fleet over there is a heck of an opportunity. So looking for how do we continue to pursue that opportunity? Also be looking at Parcel 5. This past couple of weeks, the city put out their concert series at the Olivas Adobe, mm-hmm. if I'm saying that correctly, mm-hmm. and they sold out within days. And to me, that's a that shows that there's such a demand for the public to go to outdoor concert venues and just enjoy the outdoors. We have such an awesome location over there, Parcel 5. I think that's an opportunity, and I look forward to pursuing that more this year. When we saw the city last week, City Council, we talked about active transportation and our initiatives there, so I'm looking to keep that moving forward. And then finally, landscaping. We talk about Sergio's budget. I like what I've heard recently about how we're going to more sustainable landscaping, more drought-tolerant plants. One of the things that really makes or breaks the ambiance, besides those bathrooms, of our outdoor shopping mall is the landscaping. And I think I would encourage us to put more funds to the landscaping, because it, especially in our climate, especially with the we talked about the salt air taking damage on the trash enclosures, right? All that salt air, it's challenging for the plantings, for the landscaping. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's an area where we can really make the village pop by spending a little bit more money there. And I would encourage that as you look at your budget. So I think we're pretty close on wrapping up. No more comments here. Public input, if there's all those people are online, I would encourage them. This is the opportunity, right, to give us input on how to frame the budget.
I would add that the marketing department puts out their annual survey to our tenants at the village in particular, because that those folks pay into that doesn't cover all of it. The board spends much more than that, but they contribute to a fund for marketing activities at the village. So one of the things we've done at this time is, and you heard about the survey and the vacay and all of that, right? So the idea is to get feedback from both stakeholders and folks that come to the harbor on what they like to see and so on. Remember, that results in a marketing plan that now comes to the board as part of the budget cycle. So that'll be coming forward at the next meeting. So, I don't know how many folks are online, but there are other opportunities for people to engage in giving data back to the marketing department in particular to ultimately develop recommendations for the marketing plan.
Good point. Thank you. So there are no public comments.
No public speakers.
One final point before we close this this topic is, going forward, as we talk about labor budgets, I have a request, Brian, to you and to the board. Happy to say that my son is now a proud member of the Harbor Patrol. He's a Marine Safety Officer. Darn looking good when he puts on his uniform. Good looking guy. Very proud of the role that he has.
Cleans up well.
Yeah, yeah. So that's exciting. But that presents a challenge for me. I spoke to legal about this. How do I manage this, right? If I have a conflict of interest on employee salaries, et cetera. A recommendation from legal is that we try to craft budgetary discussions. If it's a salary discussion, try to segregate that, and I will recuse myself from those discussions.
Okay.
Obviously, I want to participate in it as much as I can. It's a big responsibility of the board. So if you can, Brian, as you prepare your budgets, if you can think about that, hey, we're going to talk salaries now, I'll recuse myself.
Okay.
That puts a bigger burden on the board, right? If I had to recuse myself tonight, we would no longer have a quorum. So we're going to have to plan that carefully and make sure we have good attendance.
Thank you for that information.
All right. So I think we're going to, let's see, this was informational, I believe.
Correct.
Right. So we don't need to take any kind of vote. And we're going to move on to standard agenda number 2, the resolution 3473 and 3474.
Okay. Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to ask the clerk of the board to give a brief presentation on the recommended changes to update the employee reimbursement policy.
Good evening, commissioners. I'll make this brief. You have the two policies in front of you in your packet. These were, they're two separate policies, but they mirror each other than, I believe, one section on reporting in the commissioner policy. However, both these policies were last updated in 2016. However, they were very wordy and a little complicated. So we thought these benefited from improved clarity as well as additional direction to staff, to supervisors, to the commissioners, and to others like myself who would review these reimbursements. These updates are simplify these policies and provide additional specificity. The essence and meaning of these policies have not changed. So like I said before, we're streamlining them. We're making them simpler to follow, easier to understand. The most important update in this policy are our meal costs. Those have not changed. They are exactly the same. Breakfast is 20, lunch is 30, dinner is 45. However, those totals are not to be exceeded. Those totals are to include sales tax and the tip, and tip is not to exceed 20% of the pre-tax total. If somebody were to exceed those, they would only get reimbursed the $20, the $30, or the $45. Also, since Commissioner Stevens could not be here, he did reach out to staff and recommended deleting the phrase per diem from the meals section because it actually means entire day. And we are not proposing an entire day per diem. So his recommendation was to strike that from the policy, which staff is okay with. And that is it. If you have any questions, please let me know.
Commissioners, questions on this?
Just so I'm clear, Commissioner Stevens' recommendation, is that how did that get changed in what was presented, or do we need to make a motion accepting Commissioner Stevens' recommendation?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And just so I'm clear, that is in the resolution.
Well, the policy is an exhibit to the resolution. So, okay. So the two words per diem will be deleted from both policies.
Okay.
Which are attached to the resolution.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? I've got a couple of questions. In the employee resolution, it talks about material purchases, and would that be done with a district credit card, or would those employee purchases be done with cash, or doesn't it matter?
Usually managers and supervisors are the one that purchase supplies, and all managers and supervisors, including myself, have a district credit card. But there are some cases where an employee may have to go drop off a certified mail postage, or quickly go to Office Depot to get ink. There is the choice of possibly taking that manager or supervisor's credit card, but depending on the circumstance, they may have to purchase it themselves, and then they would turn that receipt in to accounting and get reimbursed for that purchase.
Yeah, so they could take it upon themselves, run that errand, use cash, mm-hmm. and as long as they bring back a receipt and it was a reasonable expense, I forget what the terms are here, they could get reimbursed.
That is correct.
I guess I was.
Pardon me.
Please.
So those type of things are always approved by the supervisor before they happen.
Well, and that's what I was getting at. I applaud the flexibility because that'll promote efficiency. I was surprised that there wasn't some kind of requirement. I glossed over it, but I didn't see a requirement for a supervisory approval prior to making that purchase.
Sergio can confirm that. You can confirm that staff can't just go make a purchase on their own. They have,
yeah.
to have talked to them, said yes, well, okay, go ahead and do that.
Well, usually the policy, if it's going to be a purchase for the district, we would give them our credit card with our consent, and that would purchase would be through the credit card. But if it's a reimbursement, we try to avoid that, first of all, purchases that's going to be reimbursed. It certainly happens in facilities, but if it does happen, you know, it's authorized. So That's what we do.
And there are certain circumstances where managers and supervisors do keep their district credit cards locked in their desks so they don't have them with them at all times. And for example, a manager had to make a last minute airline ticket reservation because their flight got canceled to a conference and they were somewhere else and didn't have their district credit card. So they had to put that purchase on their personal card and get reimbursed for that. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. It does. And again, I appreciate the flexibility you're giving the employees. I guess what Sergio said makes sense to me, but that's not in the policy. Thoughts about adding a requirement or adding a, maybe it's not a hard and fast requirement, maybe it's guidance that employees should seek manager concurrence prior to making the purchase.
We can add a sentence after that section D.
Okay. I would encourage that.
Okay.
That, I mean, you got a small team. I don't think it's going to get out of control. Sean?
I would just add that my staff has a unique situation where they have professional licenses that they have to pay. They bring receipts to us. So it's part of our agreement that will be reimbursed for it. So,
and that is typically done as a personal expense on a personal credit card?
Yeah, typically the licensing agencies need it from them, and then they bring in the receipts. And then the small, petty cash type purchases throughout the day, sometimes they need a part to make a repair same day to get a boat back in service. I would like to always have that flexibility that my staff knows the parameters of purchasing, but those smaller ones, if he can go over and pay $10 and get a part right now and fix a boat, that saves us tenfold if we had to pay for someone to come do the work.
Yeah.
I had to do the paperwork I had to supervise on our feet.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. That's helpful. I guess that's what I'm looking for is just some acknowledgement that the manager is involved in looking at it.
I think some of it's in the paperwork, as you heard, that goes through accounting. So, Gloria, can you confirm that basically that if someone had to make a purchase and the only way they could make it was either on their own credit card or with cash, and they were seeking reimbursement, that the supervisor or manager from that department would approve that purchase post-purchase? Otherwise, it won't be reimbursed.
They do.
Okay.
All right. So that's exactly what I was looking for. Sounds like that's in the procedure. I would suggest you look for an opportunity. I mean, that sounds like it's a standard form. Somehow build that into the resolution. And as former Chairman Stevens coached me, I'm going to trust staff to figure out how to best to do that. I've got questions in about the, I had a question about the flat very pretty. Am I like Commissioner Stevens' suggestion? And I have a question about incidentals, especially if you stay at a hotel where they have valet parking and the valet guy gets your car, you typically give him a few bucks in cash. I think what this policy says now is I'm supposed to get a receipt for that. I think that's impractical. I would think that we should allow a small amount of incidentals per day, I think. And I think trying to get receipts for valet that's the best example I can come up with. I've never gotten a receipt from a valet driver.
That's the boss's call.
it's actually the commission's call.
Well, true.
There is a section, I'm looking at it now, section B is in Victor, incidental allowance. I'm looking at the clean version. So does the clean version is the recommended version?
Yes.
What page is that, Brian?
That is on, do you see it? Vice Chair. On the packet, the packet page. So that says, and is this, am I staring at the commission one or this, or
they
the
they should mirror each other.
The district shall reimburse a commissioner for tips actually given to cabbies, baggage. That's what I was asking. So we have the old one plus a red line plus a clean one.
So it looks like on page 89, incidental allowance. Yeah, Victor.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, let's see what page number. Okay. Okay, so this one is the proposed. District shall reimburse the commissioner for tips actually given that are reasonable and customary for the service, as well as toll charges and parking fees up to the actual amount expended. Commissioners must provide receipts or documentation for incidental expenses and attach to the expense reporting form and document cash tips and payments will not be reimbursed. Any guidance, Gloria, from state? I don't know that they get down to this level.
I haven't seen anything.
Yeah.
I
mean, the one thing I've seen generally speaking from CSDA, which is California Special Districts Association, is that you should have documentation for expenses. I hear what you're saying.
Well, what does that mean, documentation?
It typically means, particularly with appointed officials, that the basis of being reimbursed, someone can show there's an internal control that can prove beyond their word that this was the cost of doing something. There have been cases and things, not court cases, but over tipping. Gratuities and the like. Why was it that much? Did you really do it? It's a protection. It's typically a protection for the public entity to limit it or to get some type of a receipt or something. I've seen some nonprofit organizations basically say to write something up. They didn't get a receipt, but put something so that in the file it would have what it was for, but it's basically because some people in the public just go mad that, what do you mean you get, why was it that much? How do we know you really, really did that? I think it's a call of the governance. It's the call for us.
The cleanest is to have receipts, right? After that, it's you're putting numbers on an expense report and you're sort of certifying that those are expenses that you actually incurred. It's not the same as a receipt. I don't know that there's any specific law that says you can't do that. But what I've read from CSDA is that you're looking for receipts. And I think that's the type of documentation you're generally looking for. I basically don't submit anything that I gave a cash tip for, but that's me.
Yeah, and I guess I've been a frequent traveler and I've kind of gotten worn out taking, the tips out of pocket.
Yeah, understood.
And especially if we're going to this kind of meal structure, when I travel for my company, it's a per diem rate per day and it's meals and incidentals. There's a flat rate I get and I manage to that. Here, quite frankly, that's not going to cover Washington, D.C. prices. And then to take tips and all that, I'm not willing to take it out of pocket. I'm already volunteering time. I don't want to take it out of pocket. So I would offer that we change or get a little bit more specific on receipts or documentation. What is that documentation? A stipulation that it was a cash tip, Is that going to put us into a, is that going to put the district at risk? If it is, then it's,
what I meant is it's not from a legal or internal control. It's just basically the, how do we know you did that? The big question, especially amongst my experience with bargaining units, is they say, well, I had to give a receipt, but the appointed official didn't, you know. That's my concern more for, as opposed to an internal control, you know, is the perception that employees have to give receipts. You bought some screwdrivers or screws or whatever for it.
Can I just make a comment?
Mm-hmm.
And I, this is a very hard policy. And as one that has been reviewing all the reimbursements for a few years now, it's tough. And I like to protect the district's funds, and I like to protect everybody here from possible public records. And I'm pretty strict with this policy, and I don't want to tell you what you can and cannot do, but just think of valet parking as a luxury, and technically, as a government agency, we're asking things to be reasonable and responsible. And my personal opinion is that valet parking is a luxury. So maybe that should be considered. But people can do what they feel is reasonable when they're traveling. But like I said, all of these reimbursements are subject to public record. And having that backup to me is very, very important. And that's why we've made this policy a little bit stricter than what it was before. And we're requesting this documentation.
Mr. Chair, I'd ask that legal counsel give any information that he may have relative to this issue. Again, I'm reading from CSDA documentation, which we're a member of. I'm not saying what they've said is specific law, but they have provided guidance to districts, and maybe legal counsel, who works with a lot of different districts, may have some feedback for us.
Sure. I think when you're dealing with employees, you have to be very careful, right? So I think you have to, like, for example, today I got another client, I got a employee verification request, and I said, well, that's way over the top. So what we need to do is look at each of these requests independently and evaluate what we're going to do. Okay? Does that help? Hello?
Are you saying looking at it on a case-by-case basis?
Yes. I think it's very difficult to just establish a, like, these have per diems in them. It's very difficult.
Agreed, I think. Well, we haven't voted on it yet, but there is a motion. There's a suggestion that we drop the discussion of per diem.
Okay. Well, that makes sense to me, because I'd rather have the employees submit these.
Oh.
I would suggest that, again, I could.
Sorry, my earphones fell off.
Yeah.
That's thanks, Andy.
There is also an option that
I'd rather have the employees submit receipts as opposed to.
No, I don't want to pursue that because I think that's a major restructure. I think what I would offer for the board's consideration is it already says, you know, the incidentals, and then I would think this would apply to commissioners and employees.
Right.
That you can get reimbursed for incidentals if you have a receipt or documentation, and which could just be a little bit more specific on that. What is that documentation? Could that documentation be a stipulation from the traveler that, hey, this was a tip for the valet or tip for the bellman or whatever the incidental was, right? We talk about flexibility for the employees to go buy materials for the job. This is just giving that
flexibility. I agree.
So that's what I would suggest.
Okay, well, we can look into it.
Commissioners, any thoughts, any feedback on that? Right? We make decisions as a board, so feel free to.
That's acceptable to me. I just think that you need, like, the documentation, because, again, you run into the case where, you know, we have to give you the receipt and everything like that. You know, I took a course, I got a license, I did that. That was part of my job, and I had to give this. But, you know, we go by your word. I think the documentation, in my opinion, would take care of that. And then that way we have it as an internal control that that's what the basis of the reimbursement is. So I concur.
So as I read it right now, for both commissioners and for employees, it says receipts or documentation for incidental expenses. At my place of employment, if for some reason I don't have a receipt, as long as it's not above a certain amount, I can sign an affidavit indicating, you know, this $5 went towards X. So I'm affirming on a very specific document that I spent X amount on this. Now there's a cap. So it seems to me that we would not have to amend this. It's more of an internal understanding that it could be the documentation in the absence of a receipt would be an explicit affidavit on the part of the employee or commissioner affirming that $7.25 went to the shuttle driver and, you know, the valet parking for those who are into luxury goods like that. Or the like. So I think there's a way to do it without actually amending what's in here or needing to change it. I think it's more of an internal policy about what does documentation mean in the absence of a receipt, because sometimes people even lose the receipt.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay. So, all right. So if we go there, I would agree with that also. I think we've had enough internal debate. Do we have any public comments on this one?
There are no public speakers.
No public comments in front of me. So does anybody want to try to craft that into a motion?
Are we, just so I understand, are we doing these because they're voice votes? Do we need to do the resolution separately? So is it two motions?
No, it can be one motion.
Okay, so a motion could be made that Commissioner Stevens isn't here, so it's not necessarily a friendly amendment. So, but it sounds like there's general agreement that the per diem should be struck. So I would say that I would make a motion for resolution number 3473 and 3474 to be adopted with the amendment that the per diem phrase be struck.
I believe from section 5, meals.
Thank you. The per diem phrase be struck from section 5, meals.
A second.
All right. So we have a motion and a second to approve resolutions 3473 and 3474.
4 with the amendment as just described by our vice chair. Since these are resolutions, we need a roll call vote. So.
And we're rescinding the old resolutions 3302 and 3303.
Thank you.
Yes. Roll call, Commissioner Rainey.
Yes.
Vice Chair Gardena.
Yes.
Chair Blumenberg.
Yes.
Vote carries 3-0.
All right, so that completes our agenda for the evening. I think we already got a look ahead to our next meeting, which is going to be our preliminary budget.
June 7th.
June 7th. All right. Before we adjourn the night, with a heavy heart, we want to say farewell to Chuck Ormson. So I have a short bio I'd just like to read. Charles Sidney Ormson was born on October 29th, 1946. He enlisted in the United States Navy on September 8, 1964, and commissioned August 15, 1977. He retired December 1, 1999, as a U.S. Navy and nuclear submarine commander, a 35-year career in the submarine force. In 2006, Chuck became the general manager of Ventura West Marina. He was a 24/7 officer and marina manager. Always on call, never missed a day of work, even during illnesses. He was always available for tenants for conversation and recommendations due to his invaluable knowledge of boats. Chuck was a man's man, strong mentally, decisive, a leader on many fronts, especially to his tenants at Ventura West Marina. His job required him to be firm, but there was also a side of Chuck that he readily displayed in more personal settings, where he'd greet people with a great big heartfelt smile, a warm, hearty handshake, and a big bear hug. He had such a well-rounded demeanor in juggling duty and community. Our hearts go out to his wife, Ricky, son, Brian, daughters, Tara and Kimberly, 7 grandchildren, and a very lonely dog, Rosie, who is still sitting by the helm waiting for Dad to come home. Chuck and Ricky have lived aboard the yacht Amor in Ventura Harbor for 17 years. Men of honor and duty are hard enough to come by in our present day. We're grateful that Chuck made Ventura Harbor his last port of call, and he will be dearly missed. So, fair winds and following seas. So, with that, I'm going to ask our harbor master to ring 4 bells in honor of Chuck. Sure. Nice and loud. And with that, we will adjourn for the evening. Thank you. I didn't like that. I just wanted to...